The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you, Sue. As always, it's hard to recognize the bio. But it's a delight to be here this morning. Is this volume okay for people? It sounds a little echoey to me, yeah. Okay, is that, I have to talk, okay. Yeah. So this morning I want to offer kind of an exploration of a quality that might be called wholeness or, yeah, if it comes out of developing mindfulness with the intention of being able to include everything in our experience. So the sense that mindfulness or awareness has the ability to hold all that might be arising in terms of our body, our feelings, our thoughts. And in a way, this being able to include and see everything is an expression of the quality that we call metta, or love, loving kindness in our practice. These are all linked together. So part of the healing of the mind is to become whole, to become complete in itself. And a related word, etymologically, is the word holistic, actually. And this has connotations, at least for me, of integration and harmony, kind of a whole systems approach. And it can also mean all-pervading, all-encompassing, or going toward boundlessness. You know, words of this nature. So is it really okay for anything to appear in consciousness? Or are you maybe editing out some things, or avoiding seeing some things, or unhappy with the arising of some things? Of course we're doing this, because this is the normal approach for the unenlightened mind. But I think we could say that through our practice, we're moving toward being okay with whatever arises, and being okay also with the fact that our mind has a lot of weird things about it. Is that okay? I know for sure when I look in my mind, some really strange thoughts and intentions and so forth may come up in meditation or elsewhere. And it's not that we say, oh, everything's okay, I can act on anything that arises. But the fact that it's arisen at some level can be okay. And then we choose what to do. So this is a poem by Eric Fried. It is nonsense, says reason. It is what it is, says love. It is a disaster, says logic. It is nothing but pain, says fear. It is hopeless, says common sense. It is what it is, says love. It is ridiculous, says pride. It is foolhardy, says prudence. It is impossible, says experience. It is what it is, says love. So to me, this brings forth some of the players in my mind. I think many of us know that we have in us these voices of reason, of logic, of fear, of pride, of love, and that they have different things to say about our experience. And in the end, you know, we're moving toward including everything. including everything in who we are and what we are. Sometimes in this practice, we'll hear words like emptiness, and sometimes we can think that that means that we have to get rid of everything. You know, there's going to be nothing left. My mind will be blank. There will be no sense of me or self. Everything's a no self. Maybe, but I think to do that, you know, before that, there's fullness. You know, before there's emptiness, and nothing is left out. There's some interesting resonances in the suttas with this. For example, this one. There are people who wander around in this world without attachments, possessions, with nothing. They are whole and complete. This is from the Sutta Nipata. Or this one, which is said to be a description of the awake person. A person with nothing in him that he grasps as his, and nothing in him that he rejects as not his. So that's interesting, right? So even the parts of ourself that we don't like, we can not reject them. And the parts of course, the parts of ourself that we like, we don't want to grasp and say, that's me, for sure. But it's interesting, right? Nothing that she grasps as hers and nothing that she rejects as not hers. Otherwise, we have a house that's kind of house divided against itself, right? And we have the never-ending process then of self-improvement, because if there's the parts that we grasp as ours, we have to keep them and maintain them and defend them and plump them up and show them off. And if we have the parts that in us that are there but we're rejecting as not us, then we have to get rid of them and modify them and improve them and overcome them somehow. So that becomes a big project, project-based Dharma practice. So when we can hold our mind more in this way that's described, one effect is that we become safe for both ourselves and for others, right? So the continual judgment of what's appearing in our experience, the shy parts aren't going to appear, you know, the ones that don't like being told that they shouldn't be there may not appear. So if you have the intention of wanting to see everything in your mind in order to understand everything about how it works, it's important to make it a welcoming place for even those shy ones to come. There's a description of the mind as kind of or meditation is kind of like sitting by a watering hole in the jungle, and you sit quietly and eventually all the animals have to come there. And you can imagine that if you're making a lot of noise and commenting on every animal that arrives, some of them may not show up. And so overall, the picture that you're receiving is going to have a distortion. It's not going to have, you're not going to see everything. Of course, our oddities will still be there, but they'll just come out in mindless ways and drive our behavior in other ways that, you know, that we're not seeing, such that we're not free. I also have this story from Ajahn Suchito in his book on the paramis. This is in the chapter about metta, about loving kindness as a parami, about the perfection of goodwill in the human mind. So he tells a little story about the monastery where he lives. As a Buddhist monastery is an open system, one gets many visitors, and not all of them are that balanced. A few years ago, a man all called Dennis used to frequent the monastery for some sort of companionship, but he always grew loud and aggressive to others in the dorm. He did what he felt was useful work, which was actually counterproductive, and in general made a nuisance of himself until he'd leave, showering everyone with verbal abuse until the next time. So, when he turned up one day in the meeting hall, there were a few silent groans, and as he started waving his arms around and demanding attention, most people left. One of the monks stood firm and informed Dennis that his behavior was inappropriate for a monastery, which got Dennis even more riled. I looked at this man with his demands, and my mind's lens seemed to widen. Poor guy, I thought, he must annoy so many people, yet he obviously comes to the monastery for company. So I found myself coming right up to him and calling his name gently, taking him by the arm and walking around the hall with him, talking with him as I did so. I had no expectations. It was just a response, but the effect surprised me. His wildness diminished and his bodily tension eased. As I commented that he wasn't a bad person, but that his behavior frightened people, he came to a standstill. I put my arm around his shoulder, and he quietly slid down the wall to sit on the floor. In a few moments, he had curled up and was sleeping like a baby. I laid a blanket over him. After a short nap, he woke up calm and coherent, stayed for tea, and then went home. He'd got what he'd been coming for after all these years. So this is not just a story about Dennis at the monastery. I think it's metaphorical for what goes on in our own mind also. You know, do we have voices that show up, demand attention, and act obnoxious in our mind? And if so, do we treat them with ill will and tell them that they are inappropriate and that they shouldn't be there? Have we ever just put our arm around that mind state and gently and lovingly told it that it brings suffering? Because, you know, stuff does show up in our mind that brings suffering to us. Anger or sadness or depression, those come sometimes. And so maybe these things need to be seen, not necessarily indulged. You know, we don't have to sit there and stew away for hours about this thing that has arisen in the mind. But maybe if we see it, instead of judging it or pushing it away or thinking that it shouldn't be there because we're a spiritual person now, then maybe it will finally get what it needs and relax away. Now, that doesn't mean that it'll be gone forever. For sure, if we pacify a certain mind state now, it might again come back. But I've seen over time that the pattern is that if it is seen in a way that it relaxes now, it tends to be a little less strong the next time. And over time, we develop a better relationship with that. The story, I think, also suggests that total acceptance is not the same thing as inaction, right? So, indeed, that is true. So, Ajahn Suchito was completely accepting of what Dennis was doing in the sense that he didn't judge it or say it was wrong, but nor did he let it just go on. He took some action. He went over. He talked to the guy. He told him that his behavior was frightening people, which is probably true. So it's not really a judgment. So there are things we can do in our own mind to deliberately train such that we can honor the wholeness of our experience in a given moment, but also train in a way that leads the mind toward less suffering in the future. Yeah, that's the balance. So there are a lot of patterns in our mind, you know, patterns of behavior, patterns of what arises. You may have seen this over time in meditation, that there are things that come again. And the key is to be able to see what is happening in the mind and not be pulled into it. Yeah, so to be able to see it and be willing to see it, not have it blocked out, but also somehow not get sucked into its orbit. Now, of course, we do again and again, but you know, this is the aim. And a number of teachers talk about a sequence or a process that we tend to go through as we learn to see and then release or escape from these habitual patterns in the mind. Martine Batchelor, for example, is someone who's done a lot of work in this area. And I'll give kind of a summary of that sequence. So at first, the patterns that are going on in our mind are basically just running, and we're not noticing them. You know, these are just the ways that we've been behaving much of our life without attention, without awareness. And this is just how the mind is developed. You know, the mind, we're born with a mind, and so it learned to be a certain way. And many people can live their whole life with very little mindfulness about what those patterns are, and that's, you know, they're just acting out that, you know, we would say karma, but, you know, those habitual psychological patterns. Then, as you start to develop attention, you begin to notice that there's a certain pattern. For example, you can see these behaviors as patterns, but you don't have enough attentional strength, if you will, to see any other possibilities. So this is a difficult state. Many people, when they begin to practice mindfulness, the first thing they say is, oh my gosh, you know, I see all this stuff in my mind that I didn't see before. This is terrible. I don't want to see all this. What does Gill say? Self-knowledge is rarely good news, something like that. So, you know, for example, you may notice that you frequently interrupt people. You had no clue. You've been doing it your whole life. But when you develop mindfulness, then that becomes clear. This is just an example. Or a tendency, in my own mind, sometimes I've seen a tendency to, if I feel uncertain about something, then I stop speaking. Like, I don't ask the question that is needed for me to clear up that uncertainty, because somehow the uncertainty itself blocks my mind's ability to think of the right question. And it's a frustrating pattern if I don't have the awareness to see it, because my mind locks itself into a state where it can't get out of the way that it's suffering. This is definitely the time not to have ill will. So this is a time, you know, if you can see that pattern and then you see yourself falling right into it, that is a good time to remember, no, we need to have, you know, try to aim to have goodwill toward what is arising in the mind. Then there comes a point where we begin to see other possibilities, like there are options, and we still can't take them. Ouch, right? So you see the pattern, you know it's a pattern, you know that this is the moment when you're about to snap at your child, and you see yourself wanting to not do that, and it might happen anyway. Joseph Goldstein describes a time when he was, how was it? He was riding in the car with somebody, and he had the thought to make kind of a self-centered comment, you know, just kind of a, here I am, look at me kind of comment. But he was, at that time, practicing not gossiping or not making comments that were unnecessary, you know, that aspect of wise speech, not making frivolous speech, basically. And so he determined for himself, no, this isn't the right time. That would be a little bit frivolous. So he refrained. And then the thought arose again, and he refrained. And then he just lost attention for, you know, as we all do, for a few seconds. And he said what he, you know, this frivolous comment that he had decided he didn't want to say, it just tumbled out. And so he realized, wow, you know, this is a strong pattern in my mind. And the tendency to just want to draw attention to yourself through speech is an aspect of conceit, and that does not go until full awakening, just so you know. So you don't have to worry if you're still acting in that way. I certainly have those tendencies. So, you know, but it's part of the process. It's a sort of a phase in the mind. And this is one of the challenges of mindfulness practice, right? That we all know, you start to see all this stuff going on in the mind and sometimes not be able to take another option. Then the next stage is somewhat gratifying because it's that you are sometimes able to take those other possibilities. You know, you come away from an encounter and you realize, wow, you know, I behaved differently that time than I have for the however many times before that. And that is a great moment when you realize the behavior changed, you know, through intention, through awareness, something was different. And this, this is the point where the pattern is cut, essentially. That break has been made. Now, that you know, it may come back again. You may not be done after one success, but basically once that has happened, it's a decaying process for that pattern. And this cutting of patterns, if you'll accept that language, could be called liberation. You know, this is what it means to be free of some force in the mind, and to not have to do that, to have other options. There's a poem by Portia Nelson. It's just coming to mind. I don't have it written down, so my quoting may not be perfect, but it's called Autobiography in Five Chapters. And it says, chapter one, I walk down the street. There is a big hole in the ground. I fall in. I do not see it. I fall in. It is not my fault. It takes a long time to get out. Chapter two, I walk down the same street. There is a large hole in the ground. I see it is there. I fall in. But it still isn't my fault, and it still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3, I walk down the same street. There is a large hole in the ground. I fall in because it's a habit. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4, I walk down the same street. There is a big hole in the ground. I walk around it. Chapter 5, I walk down a different street. Yeah, so this is the process. And if we're in a state, to relate this to the wholeness, if we're in a state where we're not able to see something, that's like when we don't see that hole in the ground, right? We're unwilling to acknowledge, okay, that's a place where I'm going to fall in and suffer. And there's so many, this is actually the essence of the word ignorance. It doesn't mean stupidity, as we often think of it in our culture. It means ignoring. We're ignoring something. Like we're ignoring that hole in the ground, and then we fall in. And nobody, you know, nobody made us do that. So the practice that we're doing sort of empowers us to see more and more, be willing to see more and more, be willing to take that on as a responsibility, and stop that habit pattern. But to do so, we have to have the strength of awareness that we can't get sucked in. You know, we can't just fall in, like in those middle chapters where she knows the hole's there, but, you know, falls in anyway. There's something about the strength of awareness not being there. So how do we practice with this kind of thing? You know, if we get the concept, but what are some kind of practical approaches to working with the mind if we want to see what's there, if we really have the intention of overcoming the ignorance of not seeing how the mind is behaving? There are a number of them, and there's way more than we could talk about. These are the techniques that we learn through our practice here. But I'll say a few that I think are important. One is to keep the attention grounded in the body. I found this to be tremendously effective, and it is. I've heard from other people that it is quite effective for them too, is that the body has a way of being able to hold emotional states or other things that can overwhelm just the mind. If we're only in the head or only, you know, only paying attention to part of who we are at that moment. So in particular, it can literally help to feel your feet on the ground. I've done this in situations where I was in a sort of a tense speech situation with someone, like a meeting or a conflict or something, and it really helps just to feel the feet on the ground. And somehow by putting some of the attention there in a place that feels stable or solid, it's possible for the mind to kind of use that feeling to have a more stable or solid interaction or way of speaking or way of holding the emotions that are arising. So this is very good. It can also help to feel the breath. And the way that the breath is changes depending on our emotional state. So if we've done some awareness work with that during meditation, for example, noticing that feelings of anger, for example, tighten the chest, or feelings of fear may tighten the belly. I don't know how it is for you. You'll have to determine in your own body what may, you know, how that goes. But I find that then the body can be a clue to what emotion is coming. Maybe before it gets so strong that it's sucking in the attention, so I can notice, oh, you know, I'm starting to feel a little tight. What is that? And so I can quickly see something in my mind before the conflagration, you know, gets larger. Andrea gives an example also of a time when she was in a drugstore and she was feeling impatient, but she didn't actually notice that she was feeling impatient through the, you know, through the mind. She noticed it because she was walking through the store quickly, grabbing things off the shelves and throwing them in her little basket. And she thought, what am I doing? And she realized, oh, you know, I'm feeling really impatient right now, and this is why I'm behaving this way. And so she realized, this is suffering for myself, first of all, to be in this kind of tight, tense, fast-moving pace situation. And she also perceived that this could be could bring suffering for others if, for example, through her impatience, you were to snap at somebody or were to, you know, barge past them and knock into their basket. I mean, maybe it wasn't that extreme. It wasn't that extreme, actually, but she perceived that this was a situation with suffering. And so she did what she did spontaneously and then later kind of figured out what she had done was a two-part training based on the intention to develop patience. And the first was that she deliberately made her body act calmly. So she, you know, imposed her will onto the way that she was walking, and she deliberately slowed down. And we can do this, right? If we're moving quickly, when we're aware, we can choose to move more slowly. But at the same time, and I think this is the important component, she did not suppress the impatience. She didn't say, oh, I shouldn't be impatient. I'm going to deliberately move slowly and be patient. You hear that kind of command to the mind. We can't really command the mind to be a certain way. Instead, she said, actually, I'm feeling really impatient. And she she turned toward and opened and didn't suppress that energy. And impatience has a lot of energy to it. That's why it comes out in the body as quick movements. But she made the body move slow while feeling the full energy. This takes some attentional strength, while feeling the full energy of the impatience in her body. And within a minute, she said, it dissipated. You know, so she was not allowing it to leak out. So it's important not to act on these unskillful feelings that have arisen. But she didn't suppress it. She just let it run its course, basically. And very quickly, when the mind was, you know, sort of open and free to do that, it ended. Because, you know, it had arisen and it passed. Things pass. They don't stay around forever unless we feed them. So I think this is really, really good practice, a combination of, you know, making the body imitate awake behavior, if you will, so making the body act in a certain way, but not suppressing the way the mind is. She was totally inclusive of that mind state. There was a wholeness to her her mental state at that time. This is a powerful way to train the mind, actually, is to not have ill will towards these things that arise, but also not allow them to leak out. You see the balance? So there's... we can practice this in sitting. This was, you know, this was an action, a daily life practice, an action in the world that was skillful. But we can practice this on the cushion in a number of ways. For example, sitting through restlessness while feeling it is kind of a parallel example. Say we're sitting on the cushion or in the chair and we want to stop, we want to get up. Restlessness can be really compelling. You can actually feel like you want to leap off the cushion. And, you know, so sitting through that energy in the body while remaining seated on the cushion is the equivalent of making the body move slowly but feeling the impatience while she was doing that. Sitting through an unpleasant memory arising. So feeling the feeling tone of it, for example, and saying, wow, this is really unpleasant. Instead of falling in, reliving the memory, going through that whole mind process again, she shouldn't have said that, I can't believe I did that, oh my gosh, that was so embarrassing, I'm so ashamed now, I'm probably a really bad person. You know, you can go on for a long time. But what if we recognized, oh, this is that unpleasant memory arising again, and maybe even notice the unpleasantness, say unpleasant, unpleasant, if you do labeling practice. But at the same time, you know, sitting there with it, letting it run its course. Probably that's going to, in a way, this is like talking with Dennis and just saying, wow, this is what's happening, and allowing it to run its course, be seen, get what it needs, and fade away. So in those situations, we're literally training the mind through right effort to have more wholesome mind states, you know, to have an intention of goodwill, to have this openness. But I want to point out that there's a more subtle thing going on too, which is that we're gaining the wisdom of anicca, which is impermanence. So if you're able to sit through an unpleasant mind state, notice that it's there. Maybe you don't notice until it's there, but once it's there, sit through it and see the ending of it. That is actually really powerful at the level of the heart. You know, it was unpleasant to sit through, but the heart learns something when it sees that something can end. You know, when it sees that without my doing anything to it, without my suppressing it, without my replacing it with thoughts of loving kindness, which is a good practice, but we're talking today about being able to sit through things. Then when it ends, the mind learns, ah, the conditions for that have ended and it ends. It's a really powerful learning for the mind. Even if you don't see it consciously, that's happening in the heart, that wisdom training. And that understanding that things arise and pass according to their conditions, that has liberating power to it in the long run, knowing that. And I'll throw in one more practice that's popular in some traditions of deliberately including everything. This is when you're feeling like you want to take it on. It's possible to do a meditation where you deliberately sit and first open to everything in the body. You know, so maybe you start with the breath. Allow your mind to calm on the breath. Open to all the sensation of the whole body sitting. And then, you know, feeling, you know, the knees, the shoulders, the contact points. And then opening to everything external that's physical. So opening to sounds, for example. Opening to that subtle sense of being in a room. We all have that. Those kinds of feelings. And then when you can hold all that, keeping that there and opening to next to the emotional states that are present. Okay, what am I feeling about all of this? And oh, there's sadness. Okay, oh, there's, you know, not necessarily tracking it along, but just feeling the mood, the emotional mood of the heart, holding all of that, opening to that, then opening to the thoughts that are present while holding all of this, making the mind bigger and bigger, thoughts, the beliefs, what are the background judgments that are going on right now, allowing all of that to be present in the mind. And then finally, the very last thing is to include the awareness. And I'm aware of all of this. You don't have to put the I in. There is awareness of all of this. So the objects, all the objects are present, and the awareness of all the objects. This is as big as it gets. And resting, and then just resting in that very, very open, inclusive state that includes the objects and their consciousness. This is the practice of wholeness. And it teaches the mind a lot to, you know, strengthens the awareness. And maybe, yeah, maybe the mind will open completely from a state like that. So this idea of wholeness, this approach of wholeness to practice, I think is a helpful way to work with this mind and this body that we're given, and to see the development of mindfulness as in a development of inclusion, inclusiveness, and that is part of the, you know, the deeper meaning of goodwill, of what we bring to seeing what's in our mind in order to be able to see everything and really banish the ignorance. So those are my thoughts on the topic, but I feel like there's a whole room here of wise hearts, and I would love to hear any comments or thoughts or questions that you have. Yeah. Wait for the microphone. Thank you. Thanks.
Some of the things that you said reminded me of the song that Bobby Dylan wrote, which has in it the line that freedom is just another name for nothing left to lose. And I always interpreted that to myself in one particular way, that we should not seek that kind of freedom, that we should realize that you can't have that kind of freedom if you weren't, because you need to have the experience to know what it is to lose and not lose things. But as you were speaking, I thought, well, perhaps that's not the right way to make that interpretation. Perhaps we should be very willing and open to losing things and then having that state of freedom in which we actually have lost some of those things to which we cling. Mm. So anyway, your thoughts caused me to interpret, well, first to remember this interesting line from Dylan's song, and second, to think about it in a different way.
Oh, thank you. That's, yeah, there's a lot of, I'm remembering that when Tenzin Palmo went on 12 years of retreat in a cave, somebody asked her what she gained from all of that, and she said, oh, it's not what you gain, it's what you lose in letting go of things that are, we only have to let go of the causes of suffering. We don't have to let go of the causes of happiness. But thank you. That's a good comment. Thanks, everyone.